Welcome to the Therapy Thoughts Podcast. This is Tiffany Rowe. I'm a clinical mental health counselor and psychology teacher in Utah, and I want to change the mental health game. The Therapy Thoughts Podcast is all about breaking down therapy-related topics and making mental health information easy to understand and super accessible. So join me for quick and direct educational episodes and some deeper dives with experts from around the world. Together, we are going to break down stigma. We're going to help each other make peace with mind, body, and food. We're going to make therapy cool and invest time in our mental health. Let's do it here, one therapy thought at a time. What's up, fam? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Therapy Thoughts. This is Tiffany Rowe coming at you live from Utah. And this episode is a long time coming. Kimberly Anderson and I met on the internet, and it was actually on a Reddit, a Reddit forum. What are those called? Forum? And she reached out to me, we connected, and we've tried to record episodes and just keep missing each other. So I'm so pumped that you get to hear our interview today. Kimberly is super, super cool. So she is a transgender woman working as a marriage and family therapist here in Utah and California. Kimberly has a history working in residential eating disorder and then behavioral health in California. And she is currently working with the transgender and queer community in Utah through Flourish Therapy. We're going to have a great time during this episode. You're going to learn a ton. I really respect Kimberly and the work that she's doing. So stick around. Let's get some therapy thoughts going, fam. Okay. We are live. Kimberly Anderson on the mic. Y'all.
Ironically, that is my dead name.
I mean, yeah.
And we can talk more about that later.
You know how sometimes when you do a podcast interview and it's just like shenanigans, that's what this is. We're going to have a good time. I'm so excited you're here.
Do we want to have low shenanigan energy, medium shenanigan energy, peak shenanigan? I mean, do we want to scale this or how do we want to do this?
Okay. So we send a form to all the guests ahead of time. And it's like, okay, what do you want to talk about? And Kimberly's like, Bigfoot, obviously.
Duh.
So that's the energy, whatever that is.
Bigfoot energy.
Yeah. Okay. So tell people who you are. What are you doing? Do we want to tell them how we met?
My name is Kimberly Anderson. I am a transgender woman. I transitioned about 6 years ago. And you know what? I say that. That's like my shtick. But I was looking at my Facebook memories and it's like, oh, wait, I have memories from like 8 years ago, 9 years ago, 10 years ago as Kimberly on my Facebook page. So I'm not even sure like when I officially transitioned because it's kind of like a slow burn. If you've ever talked to any transgender people, like there's no set date. Anyway, I kind of take the day that was kind of official as kind of the day that I officially transitioned. So that was maybe six-ish years ago.
Wow.
I was raised a Mormon boy in Utah, did the usual rites of passage of the Mormon male experience, and went on a mission, came home and dated around and was scared of committing. Dated some girls, fell in love with some girls, convinced myself not to do anything further because I was afraid of, quote, ruining somebody else's life. Mm. And met a girl and decided to get married. We both decided to get married. I actually disclosed to her prior to we got getting married that I was transgender and kind of what that meant. And this was like 25, 26, 27 years ago. So my understanding of that has kind of evolved over the years. She, you know, made a commitment to me to make that part of our marriage. As our marriage evolved, that became less and less the case. Mm. We were married 20 years. We raised two beautiful children. They are in their early 20s. And when my wife and I separated and divorced, I moved to California and enrolled in the University of San Francisco and got a second master's degree in counseling psychology and have been practicing in California as a marriage and family therapist for the past year. And then within the past 2 months, the summer of 2020, during a global pandemic, what does Kimberly do? That's right. She moves from California to Utah to start her life all over again.
Wow.
Prior to becoming a therapist, though, I was a commercial photographer for 28, 29, 30 years. I taught at the university level for about 10 years, all over Utah, BYU, Idaho, BYU, Snow, Utah State, UVU, Art Institute, Waterford School. I mean, the list, ticking them off. And I'm finding as a therapist, my experience and history as a teacher, as an instructor and working with students, you know, navigating problems and challenges and really kind of giving them counseling in a lot of ways, really has paid off as working now as a therapist.
Yeah.
Currently, now that I moved back to Utah, I have a really interesting kind of a dual role. I am a therapist through Flourish Therapy with Dr. Lisa Tensmeyer Hansen as my supervisor. And before I left to California to become an MFT, I reached out to Dr. Rick Stelukinar, who runs the Rebirth OBGYN and Transgender Health Clinic here in Salt Lake City. And I asked her, how would you feel about Kimberly going and becoming a therapist? And she said, when you come back, let me know and we will start you. We will get you into my clinic and we will get you working with the transgender people, clients. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back and got connected with Lisa, I immediately reached out to Rick's and I said, how would you feel about me being a Flourish Therapy therapist and being embedded at your clinic at Rebirth Health Center? She said, absolutely. So I have an office. I'm not in my office now. I'm at home. I don't work on Mondays, but my office is at the Rebirth Health Center in Holiday. That's only relevant because hopefully in the future, one day soon, possibly in 6 to 9 months, I might be seeing clients face to face.
Cool.
But as of now, it's all telehealth, which is kind of nice because I have clients all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
So but that's a really long introduction. I recall you saying you wanted me to turn off my cell phone before we started the podcast.
Look,
clearly, I did not do that.
You live your life. You're important. You're busy.
It's my pharmacy calling with my prescription.
Meds are cool. Therapy is cool. Thanks for sharing the background in your story. I mean, 25 years ago, disclosing that you're trans, what was the culture and environment like around that? Did anyone talk about it? Did your wife know what that even meant?
I hesitate to tell her story, but neither one of us really knew what that meant. I probably had a firmer grasp on that just because it was my life. And I had been wrestling with it since age 3, 4, 5.
Right.
Representation in the media was very negative, very stereotypical. Representation was often via daytime TV, talk shows, and sensationalism. And there's actually a really good documentary on Netflix called Disclosure that will give the individual a very good history of trans representation in the media. Much of that documentary I actually kind of lived through the media portrayal of trans people being largely negative. And I watched that documentary and I was pretty activated. I was pretty triggered. I remembered being very quiet and watching different scenes in it and kind of replaying my life a little bit and remembering how I felt and how I experienced my own sense of gender. And then seeing it on TV and going, whoa, Kimberly, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You don't want to be ridiculed. You don't want to be the butt of jokes. You don't want to be in danger.
Right.
And you're a Mormon boy. So be careful because you have the risk of losing everything, which is what happened ultimately. But I kind of postponed that eventually. I was able to postpone that just by being quiet. How did my wife experience that? We were both confused. We tried to put it within the Mormon LDS framework. And 25, 26 years ago, there really was none. There still isn't one now. Not much has changed in that regard. But even back then, it was even more nebulous and more confusing. So
yeah,
we entered our marriage and we walked on eggshells largely for 20 years about that particular issue. And other things too, kind of our spinoff concerns because of not really knowing what's going to happen to me, to us. And that led to different challenges in the marriage relationship. Certainly trust was a big one. the trust suffered largely.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go on, but I'm trying to take full accountability of my misbehavior in that marriage. I don't speak to my ex-wife, so I don't know whether or not she has any specific feelings about that. I don't know. All I know is that from my side, I need to be transparent and hold myself to account for the things that I did that were not healthy. Yeah. I don't feel good about the things that I did that were not beneficial. And I was largely kind of painted into a corner in a lot of different ways. So yeah. Much of what I did that may or may not have been helpful really was kind of a survival mechanism.
Absolutely. Survival and safety is something I'm really curious about, just in general for marginalized folks. How? Like, right, we talk about this in therapy all the time. Like, you have to have safety. How do you get safe, especially with recovery trauma? How do you get a sense of safety when you're literally not safe in this world where trans women are murdered all
legally,
the time?
Legally. There's a law called the Trans Panic Defense that you can use and successfully get out of a first-degree murder charge if you discover that your partner's trans during intimate moments. It's legal to murder trans people if you find out they're trans in moments of intimacy. Mm-hmm. So where do we feel safe? And I have to say, I come at this with a tremendous degree of privilege. I'm white, first of all. Most of the trans women being murdered are black. You know, so I'm white, I'm tall, I have 3 degrees, I know what it's like to have money. So there comes a certain degree of the way you carry yourself, the way you speak to people, the way you interact in public. I'm well spoken, part of the privilege of having education and being raised white in Utah. And honestly, serving a Mormon mission gives men, people raised as men in Mormonism, gives them a voice. Mm-hmm. Being raised as a male in the Mormon church gave me the expectation that what I said mattered and it would be listened to. And so I developed that mindset as well. So I am able to stay relatively safe just based on my levels of privilege. So I can't speak to how homeless people feel safe. I can't speak to how black people feel safe. I can't speak to how Native American, Alaska Native people feel safe. There's an airplane that followed. I live right by the airport. So we're going to hear aircraft today.
That's okay.
Right?
Real life. Hey,
we're living our real life. I live 30 feet from the Jordan River and I can see my canoe out the window and Michael paddling in a minute. I thought about doing the podcast from the river, actually. That would have been high shenanigans. In fact, we could do, Tiffany, we could do part two from the canoe. Part two coming at you live from the canoe.
Only if I'm there with you.
No, that's what I'm saying. You'll be in the front and I'll be in the back.
Two in the canoe.
Canoe cast.
Oh, let's start our own podcast. Canoe cast. Okay. So
back to safety. I am studying heavily polyvagal theory, which revolves around safety, lack of safety, presence of safety, and how to emotionally regulate and come back into that space of safety. And I'm not sure if you talk about polyvagal theory much on this podcast, but that's kind of my new theoretical framework of approaching trauma work, trauma recovery, certainly working with queer people raised in Mormonism, trying to find that place that is safe for them can be a challenge, huge, big challenge.
It's a game-changing approach. And I'm with you. The last couple of years, I've been really obsessed with trying to understand trauma and how to regulate, how to really regulate emotion with our nervous systems and understanding all of that. And I wish there was mental health education for every human, let alone therapists. I went 10 years without knowing anything about this.
Same. When I was in school, I mean, I enrolled in graduate school to become a therapist at age 48. I'm 52 now. And as I'm going through weeks of school, I'm thinking, where was this stuff when I was growing up? None of this existed in any curriculum I was ever part of.
Yeah.
And we sat down in church 3 hours a day. Once every 7 days, we sat down for 3 hours learning stuff repeatedly, the kind of the same stuff. And I kept thinking to myself, boy, if we had a nugget of psychoeducation here, nugget of psychoeducation there. How different would my upbringing have been? How different would my marriage have been? How different would my parenting have been if I had just had a little basic mental health and psychoeducation about interpersonal dynamics and communication and safety and emotional regulation and DBT skills and, you know, all the things that just come in so natural now. None of it growing up.
Nah. Tell folks what the polyvagal theory is. No one's talked about it on the podcast, and let's give them the education.
So Dr. Stephen Borges and Deb Dana are kind of the main pioneers of polyvagal theory. And at the risk of ruining everything that they will teach people that is like from a PhD research level education and understanding of polyvagal theory, the polyvagal nervous system originates in your limbic system and your brainstem. And it's a kind of three different bundles of nerves that extend to different parts of your body. And the polyvagal system basically creates an intrapersonal communication style between the extremities of your body and your brainstem to decide whether or not what you're perceiving is safe. And then the polyvagal system also has this really cool component where you can exude the safety that you currently inhabit to others through a process called interoception. And they kind of describe it as an interpersonal Wi-Fi. And the polyvagal system basically is, if I can regulate myself into a place of inner safety, I have the power to exude that safety to whomever I'm with. And if they are either in a flight response or a freeze response, they will sense my safety base and they will automatically, neurologically want to regulate and de-escalate their emotional state to meet me in my sense of safety. That's how I experience and have learned about polyvagal theory.
Yeah. It reinforces what we did learn in grad school, which is the therapeutic alliance is still the number one
thing. Yep.
And with that speaks to that safe relationship, that rapport is happening. This co-regulation is happening on a very biological level. It's fascinating.
I was blown away. It takes the whole limbic system fight, flight, freeze response to trauma to its real neurological root. And once you kind of understand polyvagal system, it puts a whole new spin on our limbic response of fight, flight, freeze. And how it's even more important, as you said, to be that space of trust.
Yeah.
It is interesting. One of the things that I have learned about myself, and I really consider this to be my superpower, is my vulnerability, my authenticity. I read a research study years ago when I was in school that talked about efficacy or the effectiveness of medical personnel with their patients. It didn't, and they studied all different slices of medicine, nursing, doctoring, different facets of doctoring, CNAs, massage therapists, mental health professionals, social workers, across the board. They looked at your education level, where your degree came from, how many degrees you have, how long you'd been in school, how long you'd been practicing. All these different intersections. And the main result from this entire is very meta study was the most important element you can bring to the room with your patient or with your client is authenticity. That is the most important factor in you being efficient or having efficacy or being effective with your client is your ability to show up in your true authentic self with that client and build that relationship of trust.
Oh boy, this gets me going because we are indoctrinated in school with this culture of fear. And the culture of counseling is very much like, do not be anything but a blank slate. Do not connect. Do not be vulnerable. Do not show up on the internet. Definitely don't be human. And I think, you know, we have these tips and skills to kind of create rapport with people. But I agree with you. I have seen this change the game in my practice by being authentic and how that affects people who come in. I mean, I am so happy to hear that there's something to validate that because we have a toxic culture within our field that holds us back.
I agree. And I find myself being judged by other clinicians when I'm visible. I'm an activist first. I'm a human being first. I don't put myself on a pedestal. I want my clients to know who I am. I want them to know my history. They need to know my history, because if they're going to come into my office, if their parents are going to work with me and they don't know I'm trans, they don't know I'm queer, they're in the wrong office.
Yeah.
They're coming to me because of who I am. Yeah. And so that's one of the reasons why I am so visible. I feel I need to be. And there's a large movement now of kind of rejecting that whole psychodynamic, you know, blank slate practice. I think it's scary coming into an office. And I tell my clients on the first day, I say, look, you're going to be really vulnerable with me over the next, you know, months that you work with me. You're going to be really vulnerable. I want to make sure this is not a one-way street. For me, This is a two-way street. If you have things about me you want to know, and they're therapeutically relevant and beneficial to your journey, please ask them.
Yeah.
I may or may not answer them, or I may answer them in a way that's not about me.
Mm-hmm.
But I want them to feel like they can talk to me and learn from my experience. And a lot of these, you know, working in small communities, it's a little bit different. I am a mentor. I am a role model. And both of those things, I don't like that space. It makes me uncomfortable, because then it makes me feel like I have to be some sort of something. And I'm really not that. I'm flawed and I'm imperfect and I swear a little too much. But I want my clients to know that I'm real with them.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I stand by that. And that's feminist theory at its heart. It's let's break down this power differential, and we're two humans together. And disclosure is a piece of that. And I wish we taught like how to self-disclose, because I think because it's just don't do it at all, people go extreme and turn, you know, people who do self-disclose as therapists tend to maybe go too far. But if we learned that nuance and gave clients permission and weren't so weird about it, maybe it could be really therapeutic.
I was taught this phrase that I kind of go back to. It's called therapeutic use of self.
Mm.
And so the first word is therapeutic. Is it therapeutically sound and beneficial to them?
Yeah.
And then how do I use myself in a therapeutic way? I use myself in a therapeutic way in every other facet of who I am, how I dress, how I show up, the glasses I'm wearing, the cute little cardigan I wear to make them feel safe, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood kind of stuff. Why not use my life history as a part of that safe disclosure to help them therapeutically?
Oh, I love that. I'm a big fan. And I think if you're that example and you're that safe space, that is therapeutic. So here for it. Let's keep changing this mental health game.
I'm with you. Let's be on a team. Can I be on Team Row?
Team Row. Team Therapy is Cool. You're rocking your Therapy is Cool tee.
I know. Thank you very much. I wore it to a thing a couple weeks ago, and somebody that knows you quite well saw that and they're like, oh, blah, 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 blah. They were so excited to see the Therapy is Cool. I have worn it to work and people are like, what? Therapy is cool. I'm like, yeah, therapy is cool. Come into my office and we'll talk all about it. I'll show you how cool therapy is. Don't you want to get
super
better?
Cool.
Don't you want to make yourself a whole, happy, healthy human being? What's not cool about that? That's the coolest thing there is. And
Thank
sometimes
you.
We need a little Thank bit of help.
You. Amen to that. I know I do. I love therapy. I've been in it most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Let's party.
I have a different experience with therapy.
Tell me.
Big sigh. We're taught in polyvagal theory to recognize and to respect and examine what's in those sighs, because that sigh is our brain and our body communicating something important to us. And in that sigh, I'm rewinding and rehashing all the negative experiences I had with therapy, starting with my father telling me that people went to therapy were crazy. We had the department head for Utah State Psychology Department two houses down the street. And I was always told that he was crazy. The people that are healthy don't go, or people that become therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists, they're the ones with the biggest problems. And I'm like, what? I'll never see a therapist. And then as I understand my trans identity, I'm like, oh, shoot. I have to see a therapist, because it's part of the gatekeeping, medical gatekeeping for trans people to transition. So I was caught in this double bind of really having to find a therapist that could help me gain access to medical treatment, medical interventions, and having this giant stigma against mental health from my father and from the church, honestly. The first edition of Mormon Doctrine written by Bruce R. McConkie, edition number one, under psychiatry, it says, see Church of the Devil. That's the entrance. That's the entry. That's the culture that the people who raised me were raised in. Wow. It's only been recently that the LDS Church has shifted away from that, has embraced actually quite nicely mental health and seeking mental health in lieu of ecclesiastical support.
Right.
They're giving bishops more and more permission and believers more and more permission to seek mental health, qualified, trained mental health professionals instead of relying on their local bishop.
Right.
So that's the stew that I was raised in regarding mental health. That actually kept me and my wife from getting our son into mental health services probably as early as he needed. That stigma kind of kept us away from it. It certainly kept me out of mental health counseling with my wife during our marriage. I had such a negative perception about it. And when I finally did find a therapist for my trans medical needs, I spent 2 sessions educating her and felt like she should have been paying me
right
for teaching her how to treat me according to current medical mental health standards. So I have not been in therapy my entire life. God, I wish I had. So my goal as a therapist is to be the therapist I needed when I was 12.
Yeah.
To be the therapist I needed when I was 20. And I needed somebody bad.
Yeah.
Really bad.
The stigma alone culturally, but then within your family system, and then the ignorance and oppression, that's just part of our training. The lack of awareness. I mean, that's re-traumatizing for you to have to do that emotional labor. I mean, we're not even talking about accessibility and privilege. Why was I in therapy at 16? Because my parents sent me, right? Like middle-class white folks, like I had access, and that's another barrier. There's so much. Yeah, there's a lot of problems.
So speaking to that, I'm actually kind of glad I kept my head down and kept my mouth shut, because let's put it into historical context in Utah. I was raised in Cache Valley in the 80s. I graduated from Mountain Crest High School in 1987. So that gives you some context. Had I come out, I may have been sent to reparative therapy, to conversion therapy. Mm. And having worked with many hundreds of queer Mormons by now, and being a foundational member of a group called Conversion Therapy Survivors, I know that people that experience conversion therapy in a formal setting, their suicidal ideation and suicidal behavior is through the roof.
Yeah.
So I think, quite frankly, my ability, my fear, and maybe my gut telling me just to keep my head down, keep my mouth shut, I think it really kept me alive. I mean, I inhabited and occupied dangerous suicidal spaces anyway. And I think had I been exposed to a more formal conversion therapy, it would have been just ultimately, you know, magnitudes worse. So I'm glad maybe I wasn't in therapy when I was 16.
Yeah.
It could have been the thing that killed me or led me to die by suicide. Yeah.
God, this is the safety piece I'm thinking about. Like, anytime we talk about authenticity, I always kind of want this asterisk caveat, like, yeah, but also sometimes holding back is how you can fucking stay alive.
Oh, we can say the F word?
I mean, yeah.
Fuck yeah. It's actually one of my favorite words. It's so utilitarian. It can stand in for all kinds of things. All right, cool. So the F word's on the table. Right on.
Explicit. And I mean, even for me, with all the privilege, all the layers of privilege, like coming to my truth about no longer identifying as Mormon, but like keeping that a secret was in a way survival in a social sense. So I'm thinking about folks like in your position, or Black Americans, trans Americans, LGBTQ youth in Salt Lake City, like literally physically unsafe. That it's not being inauthentic necessarily to hold that. It's a survival mechanism. I mean, what do you think?
I think you're completely right. This is why I'm happy to be on teamtherapyiscool.com.
Yeah.
But you are absolutely right. When I speak to queer youth, and especially transgender youth, that are struggling with coming out, I want to come out, I want to come out, I want to come out. The first thing I ask them is, will you be safe? Let's examine your family system. Let's examine the relationship between you and your parents. There's a lovely scale called the Riddle scale that you can kind of, it's a template for homonegativity or the presence of support and celebration within an individual, within an organization. Once you familiarize yourself with the Riddle scale, you can kind of take that and lay it over the top of whatever you're examining. And so I talk about the Riddle scale with these kids. And I ask them, do your parents tolerate you? Do they accept you? Do they recognize you? Or do they celebrate you? Do they really celebrate you? Because until they're kind of celebrating you, everything else is kind of a negative. So yeah, I talk to the kids, are you safe? If the answer is no, then the main challenge is what skills can I teach them? What resiliency skills? What core strength skills? And I'm not talking, you know, doing planks. I'm talking about DBT and emotional regulation and finding the middle way and finding your community in other spaces. What can I teach that kid to keep them safe until they're ready to kind of leave the nest and launch on their own journey on their own terms? It's all about safety.
Yeah. And there's going to be risk for a lot of folks. Maybe it's not safe and they pursue that anyway.
And it's a challenging space.
Oof.
Yeah.
Because the culture's not safe.
In many ways, the culture is not safe.
Yeah. Here in Utah.
Yeah, I don't speak in hyperbole anymore. I kind of used to, but I can't anymore. I'm part of the Utah Department of Human Services LGBT Suicide Prevention Task Force. And so I am gaining a broader view of suicidality and suicidal behavior, as well as I'm, you know, learning about autistic behavior, eating disorders, conversion therapy, and all those intersexualities or intersectionalities of suicidality. Specifically, you know, religious trauma or religious PTSD. So the suicidality is a complex thing, and that's kind of what we all fall back on. And it gives some cover to the religious culture in Utah. That's true. And let's face it, Dr. Brian Simmons from the University of Georgia in 2017, his dissertation was religious trauma in LGBTQ people raised as Mormon. What did they hear at church? How much trauma did they absorb and internalize as they were raised in Mormonism? 73.4% of people that responded would qualify for a PTSD diagnosis if one could be given. And that's self-reported.
Yeah.
You and I both know that when people come into our room, we can explain trauma in ways that they never even saw before. They will say things that were, that are big T or little T trauma, and they won't even recognize it as trauma. And once we kind of are able to give them a framework, once we're able to give them a framework of what trauma actually is, their understanding of trauma increases. So my point is the 73.4%, that's self-reported. An internal understanding of what their trauma is. My gut hunch is it's much higher than that. If we had the opportunity to interview each of those respondents, we would find out that it was much higher, I think. I actually took that survey in full disclosure.
Can you speak with your insight and expertise to the suicidality rates that are increasing drastically here in Utah? What else is contributing?
I hate to say this because I will be cited as an expert. I think what we're talking about is just minority stress. Ways that kids are bullied in school. The Trevor Project does a comprehensive survey every year of stressors for LGBTQ people. And that survey is up currently on Trevor Project. And we can link that to, as well. The state of Utah provides it's called a SHARP survey. And they administer that to 8th graders, 10th graders, and 12th graders every other year. And it's a comprehensive survey of mental health, social services, all different kinds of ways that the student is impacted. And then they break it down by gender identity, sexuality, race, socioeconomic status, geographical location, type of school. And the SHARP survey, it is interesting. The highest, so we're talking about LGBT population specifically right now. The highest rate of suicidality is in eighth grade for lesbian and gay individuals. The highest rate of suicidality for trans individuals is eighth grade. For bisexual people, the highest rate of suicidality is in 10th grade. So for bisexual people, it actually increases between 8th grade and 10th grade. For trans people and LG people, it goes down from 8th grade to 10th grade. And then for transgender and LG people, it actually goes down again by the time they reach 12th grade. Hmm. Bisexual people, theirs goes up at 8th grade to 10th grade, and then it goes down from 10th grade to 12th grade to be very similar to LG and trans people. So the bisexual person experiences more stigma, more trauma, more judgment, more shame as they gain courage and the ability to come out as bisexual. There is a huge problem with bisexual erasure, and that leads to their minority status even further.
Yeah.
So in the state of Utah, we see, you know, LGBT, and what are those causes? What are those minority stresses? Well, I think we can talk about those in giant nebulous ways. I don't know if this particular podcast is the place to dive into and dissect all that data. A, because I don't have it in front of me and I don't want to misreport it. And B, I think largely people that are interested in that, well, they will go find the SHARP survey and they will go find Trevor Project and they'll dive into that themselves. And most of the people that are interested in it are already engaged in the work already.
Yeah.
Like Taryn Aiken from AFSP in Salt Lake City, Robin Stevens, I mean, all these people that are working in suicidality already, they're the ones in the data. So, and we can certainly provide links to that if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the directive. You can find this. It's already there.
It's already there.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to dig and I'm in it and I had to dig.
Mm.
And I know when I ask the right people, they're like, oh yeah, here it is. And I'm like, so I gave a presentation last Friday. No, I'm sorry. 2 Fridays ago at UVU for their suicide prevention conference.
Okay.
And I shared data from Trevor. I showed, shared data from the American Association of Suicidality about autism research. I shared data from AFSP. I shared data from Utah Department of Human Services. And all of these entities I'm speaking with directly saying, can I share your data? And they're all yes, yes, yes. Mm. They're very excited and very willing to share accurate latest data if you're in a position of educating or serving or healing. So you just have to find and reach out just a little bit. And these people, and I would be one of them. I would include myself in that pool of people that are willing to help and educate and share resources.
You tirelessly do so. Like you share information and research and articles and are constantly educating. It's a lot of emotional labor.
Thank you for recognizing that.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's kickback and you're constantly trying to re-educate and deal with cisgendered, you know, straight folks who are, you know, causing more trauma on top of it. So I want to acknowledge that and thank you for your efforts. It helps me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for looking and seeing and noticing.
Yeah.
It matters.
I have a question because I've been taking notes and maybe I'm going to sound ignorant. How the shit is conversion therapy not grounds for losing a license? How
it is now.
Is it all over?
In certain states it is. In Utah it is now. And that just passed last year.
Okay.
With an exemption for religious and ecclesiastical leaders, as well as if you're over 18, you can seek out conversion therapy services as an adult. So conversion therapy in Utah is illegal if practiced by a licensed mental health professional. That doesn't cover coaches. It doesn't cover bishops. It doesn't cover anyone from the church or any church. I don't want to just single out the Mormon church, but they're the ones who fought back against this legislation. It also doesn't cover, I think it puts LDS social services in a gray area, because are they an extension of the ecclesiastical arm of the church? I know most, if not all, of the therapists that practice there have a license or are working towards licensure. But I don't know if, I mean, that hasn't been challenged, whether or not LDS Social Services is operating as a licensed body or if they're operating as an extension of ecclesiastical services. I don't know. It's too new. Why is it still a thing? It's still a thing because religion teaches us that being gay or trans is against the will of God and it's against nature and it won't get you to salvation or exaltation. That's why it's still a thing. It's because it's still culturally acceptable.
So it doesn't matter if it's unethical, and it, we document the harm. We understand that. And there's still exceptions for religious causes, which is why it exists in the first place.
And most of the time the kids that go are coerced by the parents.
Yeah.
And they'll do anything they can to not get kicked out, to not be rejected, to squash it down.
Yeah.
A popular musical talks about flipping it off like a switch.
Yeah.
It's not, that's not how it works. You can't turn it off.
Yeah.
Just like you can't turn it on. I've fallen in love with many straight women who can't love me back because I'm gay and because I'm a woman. It's a problem for me. I wish it could be a switch.
Right.
It's not a switch.
It's pretty simple minded for someone to say it's just a choice. Stop it. I mean, don't you think in this culture of marginalization and oppression and danger, why would someone opt into that when it's literally...
I left my marriage of 20 years. So let's talk about Little Miss Kimberly's losses just for a minute. Gave up my marriage. I had to quit teaching in Utah. Had to leave to find a new career. Parents have disowned me. Siblings have disowned me. My religious community has disowned me. My kids have not quite disowned me. And that's one of the reasons I moved back, was to build a bridge between myself and them over the next, you know, years. I figure I'll be alive till I'm probably 80, 85. So I have about a 30-year arc of reconciliation time frame to use. So that's one of the reasons I moved back here, not just to work as a therapist with the queer and the trans people, but mainly to work on repairing the relationship with my kids. Mm. It's harder for me to do that in California. So would I have given all that up just to wear dresses and makeup? How reductionist is that? Right. How insulting and patronizing is that?
Yes.
Why would I live my life alone in solitude and in kind of sadness sometimes, deep sadness and grief from all my loss? Why would I choose that? To wear dresses and wear makeup? Fuck you.
Yes.
Fuck you. Don't you dare gaslight me like that and tell me that's my experience. It's a lifestyle choice. Fuck you. You don't get to do that to me.
Yeah.
This is who I am. And if you're the one that rejects me, that's on you. It's not on me. My parents will die. We will not reconcile. And I will not attend their funeral. Mm. And I don't feel bad about it at all.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. It's raw, it's real, it's vulnerable, and that your voice really matters. And I believe you.
Thank you. That's my polyvagal system saying Tiffany is safe. Seriously, that's what it says. Thank you.
Yeah. I feel that sitting with you across the screen, just the heaviness and the energy you have to extend to fucking justify being who you are.
And I'm done justifying who I am. I just who I am. It's very much Popeye. I am who I am.
Yeah.
I'm done justifying it. If you're the kind of person I have to justify my existence with, I just won't work with you anymore. I have no time for that. I have no time or energy for that. I'm too busy keeping kids alive.
Yes.
I did an hour and a half intervention last night, keeping somebody alive. Every day I get reached out to by people looking for help.
Yeah.
It's endless. And cis people, straight people can help by spreading awareness and correcting misinformation and calling out transphobia when they see it. And specifically looking for ways to reach out to the transgender community, because we are incredibly marginalized. We are largely unseen. Most of the energy goes towards the gay side of the LGBT. So the bisexual people get erased and the transgender people get erased.
Mm-hmm.
So if straight cis people want to help, look for ways to include transgender and bisexual people.
Yeah. I really appreciate you sharing just those one or two ideas of people who are listening and what they can do. I don't know if you're interested in sharing more. We should be doing the work of finding out how to do that.
And there's the DBT.
Mm-hmm. and
I'm an educator. I'm proficient at sharing information. I happen to enjoy it. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those minority voices. Sounds gross to say that, because I look at myself on the screen and I'm as white as a loaf of Wonder Bread and a gallon of melted vanilla ice cream. But I'm a minority community. I'm a sexual and gender minority.
Yeah.
I am a minority that is willing and eager to educate. Not all are. Not all can. And none of us should. But I'm one who's and I'm not on a white horse. Don't get me wrong. I don't need a parade. But I am one person that will step up and educate, largely because I know people listen to me.
You said, you know, how do we look to include trans folks reaching out? What's that look like if someone's listening to this and this is the first time they've heard anything about this? It's new to them. They don't know what to do, but they want to do better. Because I bet there's some folks like that, right?
Many, if not most folks are like that. Unless you have a sibling or a child or a parent that's trans, this is not on your radar.
Yeah.
It's really not. And I have to, you know, my work as a therapist and an educator, I have to recognize that this is out of the box for most people. So it's hard to get this. My recommendation is that you shouldn't. Oh, Kimberly, let's back out of the word should. It can be very beneficial. It might be very helpful.
Gentle invitation.
I really like to eliminate the word should when I can. Wait, what was the question?
Where do we start? People who know nothing or know a little bit.
I think when you hear conversations about lesbian and gay or LGBT, and we hear those conversations all the time, but most of the time what we're hearing about is issues of romance or attraction or marriage rights. When you hear conversations that involve LGBT, specifically start listening and looking for, are they talking about transgender or bisexual people? Are they? And if they're not, why not? And if they're not, can I ask them to include those people? Can I educate myself so that I can interject and provide that information if the person speaking or sharing can't?
Yeah.
Call out when trans voices or trans experiences aren't being talked about when people say LGBT. So that would be like saying, I'm going to give a presentation now about all of the religions along the Wasatch Front. And I talk about Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox, Judaism, Wiccan, agnosticism, nihilism, Satanism. These are all the religions that are represented along the Wasatch Front. That's what that's like.
Mm.
Wait a minute. My glaring spot in that list of religions is not represented. Why not? Mm-hmm. Precisely.
Yeah.
Do I matter less because you understand my particular situation less? The answer is no, in case anybody's keeping track. I'm feeling a little fired up.
I'm here for it. Even within the larger community, LGBTQ+, there's exclusion of trans folks, right? And it's
well, and when we say LGBTQ+, the plus is marginalizing as well. We're missing asexual people. We're not talking about intersex people, a biological reality. We're not talking about Native American First Nations, Alaska Native Two-Spirit people. We're not talking about agender people or pangender people or demiromantic people. The LGBTQ, Q stands for queer and or questioning. LGBTQIA, A stands for asexual. I stands for intersex. Now, when I'm reciting off my little pantheon of letters, LGBTQIA, the A for me never, ever stands for ally. Ever.
I think
that was hyperbolic. That was hyperbolic. That was an absolute. Possibly in Utah. Possibly in Utah, the A might stand for allies, but only if you're as bloody and as bruised as I am. If the rocks that are hitting me aren't also hitting you, you're not standing close enough.
Chills. I love that boundary. And I think it's important to express that. Why? This is why that's not what it is for you or probably most folks. Two important questions for you.
Oh, okay. So my favorite color is dark green and my favorite ice cream is vanilla bean. Okay.
Okay.
Is there anything else?
Yeah. More important than that. I'm more, I have some depth. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. What's the best taco you've ever eaten?
Oh. This is tricky. Oh, we're going to lean in close and talk about tacos. The best taco I ever had. So when I was going to graduate school in San Francisco, I Ubered in San Francisco for almost 3 years.
Like you drove?
I drove for Uber. Yep.
Okay.
And 4,600 rides, blah, blah, blah. My driver rating was a 4.96, which is pretty damn good. Can you imagine me having a low driver rating? Answer no, because I give lots of free therapy in the car. So I'm in East Palo Alto, near where Facebook is creating a new giant thing. And it's late at night and I'm hungry. And there's this green taco truck just at the outside of a construction zone. And there's some Hispanic people standing near it ordering. And I'm like, I had never met a taco truck I didn't like.
That's right.
And so I parked and went over there and I got some two cabeza tacos. That's the head meat from the, oh no, it was pork cheek. They were the best tacos I've ever had in my life. And I have no idea where that green taco truck is. Second best taco truck is in Oakland by Lake Merritt on the east side of Lake Merritt. Third best taco trucks are in Stockton, California. Salt Lake City has some good taco trucks along 8th South. We're in the old Sears parking lot. Had a pretty good taco around the corner to my house here on 9th East and about 12th South, 13th South the other night. That wasn't bad. Little taco cart.
Yeah. That's the key right there.
But the best taco truck is the one that you're in front of.
Correct answer.
When I was working in eating disorders in California, I was working for Center for Discovery and our mantra was all foods fit. And so I have modified that to say all taco trucks fit.
Oh my gosh. Dude, we have so many more podcasts to record. We didn't even talk about eating disorders at all.
Not yet.
So bookmark that. Second important question. If you're going to get a face tattoo, what's it going to say?
A face tattoo?
Mm-hmm.
Probably be a cute little mole. Like a Marilyn Monroe mole.
Oh, hot. Okay.
And in that is contained the message.
Okay.
That's what it says.
Nice. Okay.
It's a subversive message.
Yeah.
A face tattoo. Wow. I have been thinking of, I have one tattoo right now. It's a suicide semicolon tattoo with some initials of people that we've lost and some initials of people that are still here. My initials are on it twice, actually. Mm-hmm. My mm-hmm. dead name and my current name. Mm. I've thought about another tattoo. Actually, I've thought about three tattoos that I want to get. I'm afraid to get tattoos right now in COVID.
Yeah.
I am nervous about that. I'm actually getting a hair trim today. First time since January.
Yeah, sketchy.
Of last year, November of last year. And I'm getting it cut outside, and my stylist is going to wear a mask and a face shield, and I'm going to wear a mask, and I'm still scared.
Yeah, it's sketchy.
Yeah, I will not do color. I don't want to be in that chair for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Trim's all I want.
Be safe, in and out.
Right? But yeah, I've got a couple tattoos in mind. So can I turn that on you? What's your face tattoo?
I got like a lot. We got feel, deal, heal.
Oh.
We got therapy is cool. We got don't be a beholder yourself. And maybe a little taco right here, you know.
Ooh. Dripping with green sauce, hopefully.
Yeah, man. Therapy thoughts, tacos, and tattoos. I mean, here we go.
TTT. Triple T.
Yeah.
That's the trifecta of therapy right there.
Yeah. I had such an honor talking with you. Like, you're one of those folks I sit back and I'm like, and not to be derogatory to myself, but I'm like, damn, you're the real deal. Like, you know what you know. And that's inspiring to me. And yeah, I just really admire you.
I get uncomfortable when people pay me compliments. That's part of my attachment style. Mm. So thank you. I will hold that in an effort to heal from my attachment disorders.
Yeah.
I mean, I trust you. I believe you. You are an expert. You are smart. So if you're saying that about me and you're somebody I respect, if you're somebody that I hold in high esteem as somebody who knows their shit, then I must by default believe you.
That's what I'm talking about.
So thank you.
Thank you so much.
We could be the Mutual Appreciation Society right here.
We have like 15 projects ahead of us. You know, we got to go on a taco tour. We got to go get some tats. We have all these podcasts. So this isn't the last you'll hear from my friend Kimberly, because we got more to break down. Thanks for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening to the Therapy Thoughts podcast. But remember, this podcast is not therapy. This is for general informational purposes only. The information on this podcast is not intended to diagnose or treat any condition, illness, or disease. This also isn't intended to be financial, legal, medical, or therapeutic advice. Make sure you're always working with your own personal, licensed mental health counselor. May you be well. I appreciate you tuning in and supporting the Therapy Thoughts podcast. If you want to dive deeper into intuitive eating and body image and self-love, head over to tiffanyrowe.com. It's the hub of all of my courses, the podcast, my merch, and information about doing counseling and coaching with me. I hope you guys stick around for more. We have lots of exciting interviews and thought leaders coming onto the podcast. So until next time, may you be well.